and we still love their music. And there's this amazing kind of timeless quality about their music too, you know, that a lot of those, even those sort of early Beatlemania songs like I Want to Hold Your Hand, and people still love those songs too. They might embrace other albums like Revolver or the White Album or Abbey Road. Those might be their favorites. But there's something infectious about those early songs that you can almost feel the idealism of this moment before the storm arrived. And I think they still convey across the decades that kind of sense of hope and idealism.
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers, and welcome to The Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first. Just like songs and a mixtape, it creates something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Andrew Hunt, a professor of history and best-selling author of Beatlemania in America, Fan Culture from Below. Now, as a lifelong music fan, I kind of feel like I've been preparing for this conversation my whole life. The truth is, I've always been more of a Stones fan than a Beatles guy, but that doesn't mean I don't appreciate that they changed everything. I don't care what kind of music you're into, it wouldn't exist without the Beatles. So the question is, how? How does something explode like they did? How much of it has to do with them, and how much of it was what was happening at the time? How did these four ordinary guys come together to create something so much greater than anything any of them could do on their own? And maybe most importantly, can it ever happen again? I've been fascinated lately about creativity, where it comes from, how to harness it, and how to use it with other people. This conversation came to me just when I needed it most. Please enjoy Andrew Hunt. Okay, welcome, Andrew Hunt, to the podcast, man. I can't tell you how much I've been looking forward to this. Welcome.
Thank you, Bob. I'm excited, too. I'm glad to join you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you know, this has been an interesting couple of weeks preparing for this, and I thought I might just provide a little bit of context for people listening. So my friends and I have been doing this dad's kids camping trip for about 20 years. It started when our kids were in diapers, and that was 20-some years ago, because now my kids are 19 and 22. This last year, just a couple of months ago, we're sitting around the campfire talking with the kids, and one of my neighbors, his daughter is in maybe third year university, and she starts talking about this course that she took called Beatles and the 60s. And all the dad's ears perk up like, what? There's a course in university about the Beatles, because we're all, you know, kind of music people. And then she started telling us a bit about this course and how much she loved it and some of the things we learned. And I'm like, oh man, I got to dig this guy up. Who's your professor? And needless to say, that's what led to this conversation. Since you agreed to be on the podcast, of course, I've looked into you and I found out, okay. And it's interesting. Like, why would I be surprised? He's a professor of history. He's written a book on the Cold War. Yes, he's written a book about Beatlemania, but also about the Cold War and Vietnam. And so now all of a sudden I was feeling, I'm kind of feeling a bit juvenile having this serious professor of history on to talk about Beatles and pop culture.
The Beatles are my favorite subject.
Okay, so. There you go. Perfect. So yeah, and we can save those for later episodes. But I'm curious, when people ask you what you do for a living, because I do admit, every dad around that campfire was like, who is this guy? How do I get a job like this? This guy's got the best job in the world. So when people ask you, first off, yeah, what do you say? What do you do for a living?
Well, I'm a professor of history at the University of Waterloo, and I've been there since 1997. And it's definitely a job that I absolutely love. I have wonderful colleagues and I have amazing students. And you really couldn't ask for a better job. I'm very, very lucky in terms of the quality of the job. It's sort of in the 1%. It's just a job I love. And going into the classroom and talking about the things that I love, I teach about the history of rock and roll, the history of the Beatles, all kinds of things, the history of the civil rights movement and the Cold War and those kinds of topics you were mentioning earlier. And a really important thing is the quality of the students. And I couldn't ask for better, more engaged, more thoughtful students. And I learn a lot from them. They bring a lot to the classroom and then it's a back and forth. And so I just consider, like you said, it's just the luckiest job to land that you can possibly imagine.
Yeah. And I've got so many questions about what it's like to teach kind of popular culture to a generation that grew up so differently. But I guess you could say that about any generation. But before we get there, I'd love to learn about your journey, because I've had a number of people on this podcast, and you look at their life and we talk about their journeys. And what you learn very quickly is it's never a straight line. And so I'd love to talk about your journey and how you got here, and maybe like when... At what point in your life did you realize this connection to rock and roll and history and the intersection of those things, and something it was something you wanted to kind of pursue as a career?
That's a great question. And I had a kind of a long and winding, start quoting Beatles lyrics now.
Nice. Are you going to do this the whole way?
Followed a long and windy road too, to get where I am. And,
brilliant.
And you know, I was actually born in Canada, but my parents were Americans who moved to Canada for a time. My father was a professor, so I grew up in different parts of the United States, in California and Utah. And so I kind of grew up on that side of things. But being a dual citizen, I had that kind of foot in both doors, which was really great because it enabled me to come back to Canada and to take a job here, to live in a community that I really love. And, you know, I think that love of history for me really started at quite a young age. And I found that, you know, especially I've always also loved popular culture. I've loved movies all my life, music and so forth. And the more I started to dig into the history of that stuff, I just really, really found that so much of it resonated with me. I found it fascinating. I wanted to find out more about, especially about the creative process, about how people create music and film and art and these kinds of things. And I started more teaching when I began my career in history. I started teaching what you might call more conventional history. But my first love was always that popular culture, and I kind of held it near and dear to my heart. And I finally, when I got tenure and I continued to advance along in the system, I thought, that's really what I want to teach about. I like this politics stuff. It's fascinating. And I've always kind of been a political junkie. But I'm much more interested in teaching about the history of popular culture and how people consumed it and what it meant in their lives. So I really especially love the history of how popular culture was, how it shaped the lives of ordinary people. When I ultimately wrote about the Beatles, that's one of the reasons why I decided I wanted to write about their fans and what the Beatles meant to their fans, because that experience of consuming that music and loving it and enjoying it and having it really change your life was always something that really fascinated me.
And so when I think about the Beatles, and I think, so if there were aliens coming down and saying, hey, we've been paying attention to you monkeys down here for a while, and people seem to be referencing this thing called the Beatles over and over again. How would you explain to those aliens what the Beatles were all about? Because this isn't an academic exercise. These aliens, they live amongst us, right? They're my kids' generation. There are two of those aliens living in my house right now who are three generations from the Beatles. Every artist that they've ever listened to has been inspired by the Beatles and wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the Beatles, but they've never looked up Beatles on Spotify or listened to them. So how do you explain to people that really don't have that exposure to it, what it was like? And that's a massive question, but I'll shut up for a while and see where you take us.
That's a great, great question. And one of my approaches whenever I teach a course, whatever course it happens to be, whatever the topic happens to be, is I try to make it as immersive as possible. So it's kind of like stepping into a time machine and going back to a certain point in time. And I try to take us back to that world and try to show people what that world looked like, so it becomes familiar to them. And then they start to understand the circumstances, the conditions that existed, the way things that were, the way people lived, and right down to, talking about what a living room looked like with an old radio, and giving people a kind of a mental image of a particular moment in history. And what we find is that there's so much of what exists back there that resonates with us and we can relate to. And it actually brings us back to the present in some ways. And when people begin to understand the Beatles before they became famous, they really see that, you know, we kind of almost make them into kind of godlike figures because they made such extraordinary music and they made this entire universe of music. And then, but the way, when we begin to study their personal lives, their youths and what they went through when they were young, when they were little children and when they were teenagers and so forth, I think that's when especially young people really begin to feel connected with them. They see that these incredible figures that loom so large and cast such a long shadow. And the amazing thing is how many people I get in those courses that say, before this, I was never really into the Beatles and I didn't listen to them very much. But once they find out about them, they're, wow, this, you know, and I think a big part of what makes them go, wow, is not just listening to the music and hearing how amazing and textured, and there were some Beatles songs that weren't great too, but a lot of it is, there's a lot of amazing music there that they take in and they listen to it one song at a time and maybe all the way through. I encourage people to start at the beginning of an album and work their way through both sides of it like they did in the Beatles era, and I think that really resonates with people who not only come to understand the greatness of the music, but really begin to see that the Beatles on a human scale, that these are people just like us and that they felt the same, many of the same things we did. They just lived in a different time with different technology and different conditions and so forth. And I think that on that personal level, when you can bring history to people on that personal level, that's when it really means something to them. And that's when they want more. And that's when they begin to feel a real deep connection to it. But what I found with the Beatles, and one of the reasons why I decided to narrow it down to the Beatles, is that I found that their lives kind of paralleled the changes in the 60s in really fascinating ways. And if you follow them from the beginning of the decade to the end of the decade, in many ways, the ways in which they evolved and grew and changed paralleled in just really fascinating ways the changes and transformations that were happening in the 60s. And so even as you see them kind of really getting into early rock and roll when they're in the early 60s, when they're the Quarrymen, and then they change into the Beatles, and then Ringo eventually joins them, and Pete Best leaves the band, and all that kind of stuff, you find that runs parallel to the early history of rock and roll. But as the Beatles begin to change musically and evolve and become more layered and textured and begin to move in the away from the kind of love songs that they sang early on and the rock and roll or influence songs, and they begin to move in a more poetic kind of direction and start to record music that's more textured and layered, and there's still a lot of love songs, but there's also a lot of other themes starting to come in too. This is happening against a backdrop in the mid-60s of all this experimentation and the growth of the counterculture, and starting to want different things from their music and their art and film and so forth. And so I think the Beatles reflect these changes in really fascinating ways, and they continue to evolve in striking ways throughout the decade. And the students see that, and I think they really love it too. They find something about that evolution that really strikes them, because they're starting off their adult lives and they're looking ahead to an uncertain world and not knowing exactly where they're going. But they see that these artists who now loom so large in our imagination, that they were starting at a similar kind of place, and that they were facing a number of ways, directions they could have gone, paths they could have followed. And so I think it's that personal connection and trying to put something on a human scale that may seem so epic when you first glance at it that you think, well, I don't know. I don't know about those Beatles. But then when you start to get into it, you're like, oh, okay, this is, I'm starting to feel this now. So,
wow. That's amazing. One of the things I think about, you know, it's funny. I appreciate the Beatles. I'm not a massive fan. I have friends that are fans. And if I look back on that, I'd say I'm a bigger Elvis fan, maybe a Rolling Stones fan. And so one of the things that my friends and I talk about sometimes is, let's take the song, you know, Satisfaction from the Stones, you know, one of their big hits, and the lore around that unique sound of Keith Richards' guitar was that in a drunken rage or something happened, and there was a screwdriver that he stuck through the speaker of his amp, and that's how he got, just by pure accident, this raunchy bang, bang, da, da, da. But we think about a teenager sitting around on the carpet, probably listening to the radio, hearing that song for the first time. None of us can appreciate what it's like to hear that song for the first time, that sound that you've never heard before come out of your radio and the effect that that would have. And I wonder too, like, what was going on for the Beatles? You know, we see the crazed fans and the girls losing their minds. That first time they heard I Want to Hold Your Hand or one of those early songs, like, what was it about what was going on in their lives and the combination of that and that music that just sparked something that was had to have just been seething under the surface, and they just came out around at the right time and everything just went apeshit? Like, how do you, I don't know, that's a long-winded question of just the fascination of how those things can combine. And I wonder what was happening at that time that made that such a special time.
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think that the Beatles came along at a fascinating moment. And before I mention any more about that, I also want to preface my comments by saying I'm also a huge Stones fan. In fact, when I was younger, I was a much bigger Stones fan than Beatles. And it was only later when I created a course on rock and roll that I thought, oh, I want to make a sequel to this course. I've really enjoyed teaching it. And so I started to formulate the Beatles course and read everything I could about the Beatles and listen to all their albums. But in my youth, I was a real Stones fan, so I'll probably get back to them at some point. But that period of the mid-60s was just such a fascinating period, because you really felt like it was right before the storm of the protests and the upheaval and the counterculture coming in and all of the remarkable changes that happened later in the decade and in the 1970s and so forth. But the Beatles came along right at this specific moment where, you know, the hurricane hadn't quite arrived yet, but you could see the choppy seas, to use an analogy. And I think that the music they were recording at that period of time really grabbed young audiences. And I think one of the myths is that it was just young female fans that grabbed onto the Beatles music. But really, the Beatles had a massive fan base of both young men and young women. And their music really seemed, at the time when people would listen to it, it seemed fresh and exciting. And it was a kind of new kind of music that a lot of listeners felt like they, even when the Beatles were sort of remaking old Little Richard songs or doing some Motown songs that had been recorded, there was a feeling that there was this kind of freshness and excitement about it, that the Beatles seemed to infuse this kind of optimism, and they just had this great vibe about them that was youthful and exciting. And I think also the fact that really the Beatles represented some of the biggest outbursts of creative energy coming from Great Britain. And there was finally this awareness in other parts of the world, in Canada, the United States, and elsewhere, that Great Britain is this amazing place where there's this great creative energy coming out in music and other areas too, in film and art and literature and so forth. But the Beatles really kind of kicked down the door and made people aware of this amazing artistic outburst, this kind of renaissance that was coming out of England at the time. And many of these bands that were forming at the same time as the Beatles started to come on strong too, like the Dave Clark Five and the Rolling Stones and the Animals and all those great British invasion bands that we know so well now, the Who and so on and so forth. And we still love their music. And there's this amazing kind of timeless quality about their music too. You know, that a lot of those, even those sort of early Beatlemania songs like I Want to Hold Your Hand, and people still love those songs too. They might embrace other albums like Revolver or the White Album or Abbey Road. Those might be their favorites. But there's something infectious about those early songs that you can almost feel the idealism of this moment before the storm arrived. And I think they still convey across the decades that kind of sense of hope and idealism. There's just no denying that when you turn on those songs, just like when you turn on some old Motown songs and you feel the exciting energy coming out of that, you can kind of feel that idealism that speaks to us over the course of the decades. And I think that's what resonated with early listeners who were turning on their transistor radios in 1964 and hearing this music for the first time and screaming and jumping up and down and getting really excited about it.
Yeah. And I love the way you describe that. Of course, it, you know, when you're describing it, it sounds obvious that the, if you look at the evolution from their early stuff, which seems real, I mean, beautifully crafted and lyrics, but very simple compared to, you know, Let It Be and Abbey Road and those later ones. But it, that it very much kind of mirrored what those young teenagers were going through. And they were saying the things that people didn't know how to say, or making them feel things and giving them an outlet for that journey that they were going on through that, you know, everything that was going on in pop culture. That's, I mean, yeah, that's, I guess I hadn't really thought of it that way. It seems obvious when I think about it now.
I think, you know, the Rolling Stones did a similar kind of thing in the mid-60s when they came on strong. I think they were creating their own unique form of music, but they were also borrowing, as the Beatles did, as all these bands did. They were borrowing also earlier styles and sort of blending these different styles together. And I think that's what made the Rolling Stones so exciting is, you know, these were musicians who listened to Muddy Waters and they listened to John Lee Hooker and they listened to all these great old blues musicians but they were making their own sounds and they were creating this music that blended various different styles. But they were also adding a real oomph, a real kind of energy to an excitement to music that was already somewhat familiar to people at the time. And people could relate to that earlier music, but suddenly there's this more high-charged version of the music that people hear on the radio, and it gets them very excited. And this is a moment, too, when technology, one of the themes I talk about in my Beatles course is the development of technology. We've dealt with this all of our lives, these new technologies being introduced at various points in history. And that was certainly true in the 60s, when not only were transistor radios, which were huge starting in the late 50s and into the early 60s, those were coming on strong, but also there was this kind of revolution in stereo sound. And so it was really exciting to bring home your Rolling Stones album or your Beatles album, Aftermath or Rubber Soul or whatever, and put it on the turntable and lower the needle and just listen to that music flooding out of the speakers is just such an exciting feeling for people who were hearing that music for the first time in 1964, 65, 66. So.
Well, and yeah, that's definitely something. It must be interesting talking to people, you know, the people in your, in these lecture halls, because they grew up with every song ever made at their fingertips, and they can sit up and they can look it up and listen to it, and they can listen to 10 seconds and be like, yeah, no, don't care for it. Whereas this idea that this sense of ownership that you had, because you'd hear even in my generation, I wasn't around for the Beatles, but that I would hear something on the radio and then I would save up my money and then I would get on a bus and take it to the record shop and buy an LP and come home and listen to it like 50 times, and it just became infused. You knew every word, every note, that sense of ownership they have over this music that seems to be something that is just lost when it's so easy to get.
Oh, yeah. And one of the things that I find very rewarding when I teach about the Beatles or when I teach more broadly about rock and roll history is I really love it when the students come to me and they tell me that this music that they are listening to in the class is a way of connecting them with either their parents or their grandparents, because they hear from their parents or they hear from their grandparents just what you talked about, that experience of coming home and putting the record album on and listening to it and or the CD when it came out in the 80s and 90s and so forth. And that experience of listening to the music for the first time and really taking it in and feeling it. And so it's funny how many people that I get who are now, you know, their late teens, their 20s, and they really love Led Zeppelin, or they really love the Beatles, or they really love the Clash, or they love these, and they heard it for the first time from their parents. It's amazing to me how many of them really find that this music not only still resonates with them, but it connects them with generations. It connects them with their parents, their grandparents, their aunts and uncles, and so forth.
Yeah. You know, my kids went through their kind of rap phase and stuff that, you know, music I didn't really like, but, and it's not stuff that I'm not crazy about them listening to at a certain age, but I'm like, yeah, every generation ever has gone through this. So just ride it out. I take so much pride in walking by their bedroom doors and hearing like a Stone song or a Tragically Hip song or whatever, like this music that I knew they grew up. It's kind of like me growing up with ABBA. Right. Like, I'm not a massive ABBA fan, but that was what was going on downstairs when my parents were partying and I was trying to go to sleep upstairs. And it's it takes me back to being a kid. And that does create this connection with across generations that it's just really hard to get anywhere else. And it's pretty amazing.
I agree. There's nothing that takes you back quite as much as a song.
Yeah.
A song that really resonates from a particular moment in your life. That's for sure. Yeah.
A couple other things I needed to touch on. One, and this is something that I actually talk about in my work quite a bit, this idea of, you know, in my work, it's usually a team, how a team can be greater than the sum of its parts. And I usually go back to examples about the Beatles or the Rolling Stones. And you can look at, for example, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a huge Keith Richards fan and I listen to some of his solo albums, but you can't look at the Rolling Stones and then look at these individual careers. They're unrecognizable. They're not the same. These two people wrote some of the greatest rock and roll songs ever. And yet individually, they just don't have the same, you know, they just don't have it. How do you think about how much better the Beatles are as a collection compared to how they are individually? Because you mentioned earlier this idea of creativity, and I wonder how you think about those things.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that there's no question, as somebody who has all the albums from the solo years as well, and who has, you know, really loved those albums too and enjoyed them, but they just don't quite hold up the way that, you know, it's like if you listen to Mick Jagger came out with a solo album in the mid 80s that sounds almost just like the Rolling Stones, but it just doesn't have the same excitement and vibe to it. And the Beatles solo work was very similar. I mean, some of it was just really exceptional, but collectively, it just, like you said, it couldn't hold up to the music that the Beatles are recording, which is just on a whole other level unto itself. And I think that partly has to do with the creative synergy between the various band members, that they were really connecting with each other and their creativity, and they would have ideas and they would sit around in these sessions where they would write songs, and then they would bring what they'd written to the group, and they would all sit around and add things to it, and they would add elements to a song like Eleanor Rigby, and each one would kind of pitch in a little part of it, a little element, and they kind of fed off of each other in an amazing way. And those creative connections show that synergy that was so instrumental in creating so much of the Beatles' best music really was a vital part of the creative process for them. And it really was something, I think, that elevated their music, not only above their solo music, but above much of the rest of the rock music landscape out there. And they themselves admitted that, you know, they were put out their best music when they were together, and that was something that they participated in as a kind of collective group. And I think that recognition of that is really their way of acknowledging that creativity is often not a solitary process, that even as we ourselves as individuals grow creatively, we're always taking in elements of other people's creativity, and we're saying, oh, okay, this is really cool. I wonder what I could do with this, or you know, maybe I'll sort of borrow this element in some of my writing or some of my music or whatever it is I happen to be doing, and run with it and see what happens. And that's how we grow creatively, intellectually, in just about every area. We see examples of something that inspires us. And that's a perfect example. In fact, that's a textbook example, really, of that creative synergy working together to create this amazing music was when the Beatles collaborated together on these projects, and they would come together and just make this amazing music. And other bands did the same. The Stones did the same, and The Who, and all these. And some bands would play off of their personality divisions more than the Beatles. Like, I know The Who clashed a lot and had some creative differences, but those drove them in a different way. Those made them all sort of shine and excel in whatever it is that in whatever music they were making. So it's fascinating to study how this creative process results in this music that changes people's lives and changes the course of popular culture.
God, I love that. I could sit around and think about the Beatles on my own for hours, but just having a conversation was like, oh yeah, my God. Oh my, like these aha moments that you just come out of nowhere because of somebody provides a kernel of perspective or a different way of phrasing things or a different viewpoint. It's just, it's magic. Now, one of the questions you must get from students is, could this ever happen again? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think people sort of look back on the Beatles and or any other band, any other group that they really loved, whether it's Elvis, the Beatles, Led Zeppelin, Janis Joplin, the Clash. You know, you could kind of go through a long list of amazing musicians. And I think there's this kind of sense among a lot of people who listen to their music and really get into their discography and really try to take in all their amazing creativity and amazing music. There's this almost this kind of sense that there's this world that we've lost, that creativity now just isn't as vibrant and exciting. And we live in a very different age when it's harder to break into the music industry and it's all so much of it's driven by digital music and it's harder for people to sort of make a living off of music and these kinds of things. And people begin to develop a sense of this kind of golden age of the past. But I've always been of the belief that, you know, these golden ages, I've studied history enough to know that these amazing outbursts of creativity, these creative renaissance periods, really are cyclical, and they emerge in different times. Oftentimes when you least expect them to emerge, British invasion, for example, came about at the same time when Motown was emerging and folk music was coming on strong. But they came after these kinds of periods of relatively sedate creative output among musicians and filmmakers and so forth in the 40s and 50s, when all these exciting experimentations that weren't really happening as much. And suddenly there's this big outburst of creativity. And I think history teaches us that, you know, these things really are cyclical, and that human beings are, from generation to generation, they come with great creativity and the capacity to make amazing art. And so I always try to tell students, don't just look to the past, but try to find areas of the present that you find inspiring, because that's how we create our own music and art and film and literature and so forth. And when you look, you'll find it. You know, that oftentimes the people who say, oh, there's nothing good happening right now, I find that tells you more about them. They're just not listening. They're not tuning in. They're not trying to find this great stuff. And so I try to impart this message to students that creativity comes at all moments of history, and that we just have to know where to look.
Oh God, man, I love that, because you're right. I think it feels a little harder to find it, maybe, because the easiest thing I'm guilty of is Spotify, and just go to, you know, Chris Stapleton Radio, and the robots will just feed me up whatever it thinks, you know, I will like about that. So if I have to work a little harder to go off-roading to go find those, and I mean, nothing wrong with the stuff that's coming out of my speakers, because it's all really great stuff. But yeah, I really love that idea that it's cyclical, and it's such a human thing that it's never really going anywhere. It just changes.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. Wow, that is awesome. So I could talk about this forever.
Me too.
I kind of dread a little bit my friends listening to this podcast, because they're going to be like, oh my God, I can't believe you didn't ask him about this. Why didn't you ask him about that? Why didn't you should have asked him about this. So there's going to be a lot of that, but just so amazing. I'd love to hear, Andrew, what are you most excited about now? What's next for you?
Right now I'm sort of debating about where to go from here in terms of, I have some plans to do some writing. I'm going to be taking a sabbatical soon, but I'm also really excited about the prospect of either maybe doing what you're doing right now, Bob, and that is to do some podcasting. And I've always been interested in the history of popular culture and creativity and these kinds of issues we're talking about here that I'm enjoying so much. But I also have thought about too, maybe possibly I've been learning video editing and possibly starting a sort of YouTube channel that reflects these interests in pop culture and history and so forth. That's a little more work. I'm not sure if I'll go that route, but I'll see in the coming months. But, you know, I think whatever you do to take on something that you feel like is creatively exciting and enjoyable is so important and engaging, that it engages your different areas of your mind that you can really contribute. And so that's why I think these creative undertakings, when people find something that they feel really passionately about, that's what I like to do too. I like to seize on those and say, okay, this is what I'm thinking now. This might be a good direction to go in. And with the technology more accessible than ever, and with an audience out there that I think really likes to find out more about the past and connect it with the present and figure out these kinds of issues that we're talking about here. If I can find something along those lines that really help people to sort of learn pop culture history and hopefully enjoy it and find out about what's happening in the world around them today as a result, that would be my ideal next step. But we'll see how that unfolds, because you can go in any, like we've been talking about the whole conversation, you can kind of follow any number of pathways to get there.
Well, I hope you do launch a podcast, because I think it would be so interesting. And I just want to go back to something you said, and I think you've done a really good job even in this conversation of taking me back and trying to paint a picture of what these different eras were like and what made the Beatles so special and how it happened. And we have obviously just scraped surface, by the way. So thank you for that. And I think if you had a podcast, and the beauty of YouTube, of course, would be you could share video and audio and just make it even more immersive, like you talked about, which would be cool. But you're absolutely right. My producer, Amy, would tell you video is another ball game. So maybe start with audio. But the other thing I did in preparation for this, and I swear I'm going to do this, is I looked up the next time your course is on the schedule, the Beatles course at University of Waterloo, which is maybe a 20-minute drive from here. And I don't know how many rules I'm breaking, but I'm going to be sitting in the back of that class one of these semesters, because I don't have to take the tests. I don't need credit. I just want to be part of this. It sounds amazing.
There's an open invitation, Bob. So I would love to have you in it. Yeah, that would be fantastic.
You can look for me and I'll be the one, you know, sitting in the back, just marveling at it all.
Right on. That sounds great.
Andrew, thank you so much for this. God, it's been so good. I've got so many more questions. Maybe we can have you on in the future. We can talk about the Cold War. We can talk about Vietnam. We can talk about all the other amazing topics that you explore with in your books. So thank you so much for being here.
I would really love that. Thank you. Thank you for having me. This has been a real pleasure.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Jean-Michel Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.